ready. So we just had a technological issue this morning. Welcome to the first Senate meeting of the year. Margaret Crowder, the new chair. We have Jennifer Hanley over here, returning vice chair. And then we have Heidi Alvarez, our secretary. And then we also have new up here in front, or relatively new up here in front, is Kiana Boca, our new SGA president as well. So that may be the only cheering you do today. We've got a long agenda. We'll see how it goes. But I just have a couple of notes for you, and then we'll get to it. First off, I would request, and you all returning probably know this already, that all senators, all voting senators, please sit at the tables. And so if you are a voting senator not sitting at a table, could you please find your seat at a table, please? So all voting senators, please sit at a table for recognition and then also for access to the microphones. If you are non-voting, if you're not a senator, if you could please have a seat in the peanut gallery, as they say. There are some more comfortable seats out there anyway. So we have an official parliamentarian this year. So Robert Dytle has agreed to be official parliamentarian. I'm very pleased. So we do have a very long agenda. We're going to go ahead and get to it. So that is my basic report to you. So I'm going to turn it over to our vice chair for anything that Jennifer might have to say. Chemistry.
So let's thank our colleagues for their willingness to step up to the plate. We are still recruiting actively members for some of the Senate standing committees. So if you are just so excited about Senate and can't get enough and would love some more Senate meetings, just let me know. I'll be happy to find a spot for you. And
way to fill my committee
there. As for Allison Langdon and academic qualities, other than that, welcome back.
All right, thank you. And Heidi.
Hello, everybody. This is the microphone. If you have something to say, please speak into the microphone. That is so that if I miss it, I can go back and listen 100 times until I get it right. And there is a sign-in sheet over there. It's in a yellow folder. Please make sure prior to every meeting that you cross your name out, so that the procedure is to cross your name out if you are here. Yes, I know it's strange. I didn't create it, but that's how to do it. If you are subbing for somebody, you can sign your name on the line to the right of the name of the person that you're subbing for. Also, I have tried to make this accurate, but the Senate attendance roster seems to fluctuate like the stock market. So if you are supposed to be on there, but you're not, could you please write your name in and I will correct it. Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi. We will go ahead and move to our advisory members. Patty Minter, our faculty regent.
All right. My full report is going to be posted on the Senate website, and I will send you a link when that is posted, but this is what I'm going to call the highlight reel. So the Board of Regents met twice since the last Senate meeting in May, first at a called budget meeting and committee meetings on June 21st and later on July 26th for the third quarterly meeting. At the June meeting, I spoke against the Executive Committee agenda item, which authorized the issuing of agency bonds for a new Honors College and International Student Services building, as well as raising concerns about the project. I made 3 points about the project. It won't retain students, it won't attract them, and we cannot afford it. At the full board meeting, which followed, I voted no on the university budget for the first time ever. Never voted no on a budget before. And I was joined in dissent by Regent Corey Dodds, so that was an 8-2 approval for the budget. Why did we oppose it? We opposed it because the budget included debt service for the agency bonds next year. And just so you know, the debt service on that bond is going to be $1.5 million annually. This represents a major departure from assurances President Ransdell made in 2011 that tuition dollars would never be used to fund capital projects. And even though there were assurances from the president and the provost that any leftover monies would be used for future salary pools, I think this speaks volumes about the university's priorities. The faculty should not have to wait for leftovers. After the one-day board retreat, which was in July, the full board met on July 26th. And this time, the full board voted on the agency bond and the associated property purchases. They were passed by the full board by a vote of 8-3. The three negative votes on all three agenda items, the two property purchases and the agency bond, came from the regents who represent every single employee and student on this campus. Myself, Staff Regent James Kennedy, and Student Regent Kiana Boca. As I said during the discussion, if this debt service draws money away from academic funding priorities, such as upkeep for existing academic spaces, recruitment and retention of excellent faculty with competitive salary and benefits, and funds we need for academic programs, then it hinders all of our action plan goals. To briefly summarize the other actions at that board meeting, I voted against the contract extension for Ray Harper, who is now making $500,000 and had no competing offer on the table. There was also a spirited discussion between President Ransdell and Regent John Ridley at the board retreat concerning the name change for the Downing University Center to the Downing Student Union. This did not go through the board, and several regents think that the president should have taken it to the board for approval. There was also discussion between Regent Larry Zelke, President Ransdell, and myself at the full board meeting on why the faculty handbook did not go to the full board for approval. And it was Regent Zelke who brought it up because he thinks it should have board approval as a trial attorney for a living. Now, I agree. Even though I disagree with some of the board's recent decisions, it is the university's governing board. It is responsible for all fiscal decisions, for all programs, and all policies. The buck stops there, and the board should have been consulted on both decisions. Now, the words of our founder, Henry Hardin Sherry, appear on campus statuary, on T-shirts, on bridges, and I noticed that the Spirit Makes the Master is now on side buses, too. But as Dr. Cherry wrote in the 1932-33 annual report, which described how the university would survive the Great Depression, he declared that all non-academic expenditures must temporarily cease because Western, quote, realizes that school systems, organizations, courses of study, buildings, grounds, and equipment are dead and useless things unless they are vitalized by a faculty that has vision, leadership, character, and the spirit of service. Now that is something I'd like to see on the side of a bus.
Thank you, Regent Minter, and yes, Sony Vaio screensaver is for you guys, apparently. Sorry about that. So next, let me go ahead and move to the meeting minutes from May. Since I skipped those, I apologize. That is called technology flustering me. So let me go ahead and see if we can get a motion to approve the May meeting minutes as posted.
So moved.
Second.
And all in favor? Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Minutes are approved as posted. Let's go ahead and move on then to Dr. Emsley, our provost.
Okay, thank you. A little bit longer than usual today, perhaps. We have a report on the various recommendations from the May meeting, the Graduate Council report, the UCC report, the UCC policies amendment part one thereof. Then report 045, referring to policies on the evaluation of student instructors, summer-winter compensation for faculty, and the overall faculty workload policy, all approved. And, of course, a variety of recommendations from the April meeting resulting in the 19th edition of the faculty handbook that Regent Minter just talked about. As you're aware, over the summer, we formed the Center for Faculty Development. I just want to give you a brief update, a report on activities from that center so far. Carried out a number of evaluation projects, research projects, including things like new technologies used in online courses, the effect of social networks and retention in the communication department, an experiment to assess cheating in online and face-to-face English 100 courses, Gen Ed outcomes assessment. Also dealt with various workshops on innovations in teaching, learning, and technology, including ADA compliance, multimedia use, best practices and discussion boards, electronic grading. Faculty mentoring program is off to a good start. The new faculty were introduced at new faculty orientation, and a total of 16 have now been paired with mentors in similar disciplines. And the CFD is currently studying other faculty mentoring programs at universities such as UC San Diego, Nolan, Illinois, Marquette for best practices to use in these programs. Have expanded into a partnership with the Vice President for Research Office and the Office of Sponsored Programs. I've conducted 6 workshops so far on internal grants, RCAP, external grants, administering grants, contracts, grants, accounting, and so forth. And last but not least, the new BISCIT program, which is the unpronounceable acronym BPMCT, but it's still BISCIT. It's the training program for graduate teaching assistants. There's a total of 13 workshops scheduled throughout the fall. We talk a little bit about a report that I'm currently working on. I will present to the board, or the Academic Affairs Committee of the board, a week tomorrow. And it reflects on the incoming freshman class, which may not be the largest, but it is certainly the strongest. Last year, we had 2,405 students in what we call the cohort, first-time, full-time baccalaureate seeking. This year, that number is up to 2,446. It is the largest cohort in the university's history. The decline in enrollment has mostly been in the non-cohort students, part-time students, associates, degree seekers, and so on, down from 760 to 417. Much more significantly, I think, than that even, the average ACT of the class has gone up by a full one-half a point. President Ransdell used the number 21.9 at convocation. There's been a lot of, you know, adding and subtracting since then. The final number is currently running at 22.0, which is the average ACT of the class. Again, the highest of any class ever. And we're confident that this increased quality of the class, increased academic preparedness of the class, will result in higher retention going forward. We have also exceeded already our 2017-18 goal for diversity of the incoming class, with the percentage of underrepresented minorities in the class now exceeding 15%, which was the 2018 goal in the action plan. Over the summer, we've been fairly busy working on something I addressed the Senate on back in, I think, April, on something called CAHEA, the Kentucky Adult Higher Education Alliance. This replaces the concept of the Commonwealth College, which would have been a new institution in Kentucky serving adult learners, and replaces that with an alliance concept whereby a student can enroll at any one of the public institutions in Kentucky and earn a degree from an institution, but involving courses taught by the conglomerate, if you like. I want to thank publicly Beth Lavis and Dennis George, our representatives in that committee, who put in noble work over the summer. There was a series of get-togethers with, I met with a faculty group that the Senate appointed during July for advice on how to proceed. And on September 11th in Louisville, we met to produce what we consider our kind of working draft. We submitted that to the provost group. It was accepted by that group and has been submitted to the president's group. They will consider it in early October. If this works, it'll work something like this. A student will decide, an adult learner, which we have finally defined, by the way, is someone who is, let me get this right, has accrued at least 24 semester hours of college credits to date and satisfies at least one of the following 5 criteria, and that is either 23 years of age or active military duty or veteran or earned a GED from a high school class more than 3 years old or financially independent as defined by Title IV. So if you meet one of those 5 requirements and have done at least 24 hours of college credit, you are, for the purposes of this program, an adult learner. You can enroll in an institution of your choice, receive a degree, which we hope to provide in some kind of competency-based modularized form, hopefully including prior learning assessment as a means of getting the student closer to that baccalaureate degree. Other universities may provide courses. So, for example, if a student enrolls in a degree program offered by Morehead and they use one of our courses to earn that degree, it would show up in a Morehead transcript. Morehead awards the degree, but WKU would receive the bulk of the tuition for that course through some form of transfer arrangement, which we would treat as essentially consulting for faculty who work in those courses, so that would essentially result in supplemental pay for faculty teaching courses within this program. Again, right now it's a working draft. I suspect this will come out in some more concrete form from the President's Council and from CPE. It will be part of the discussions with the legislature going forward for the funding next year. One of the ideas is to have scholarships funded by the state that would go not to the institutions but to the adult learners themselves to offset the price of tuition to lower the cost for those individuals, and we hope that some combination of scholarships from the state plus employer contributions will help this become more affordable for adult learners. If you were reading your U.S. news on September 9th, you'll notice that WKU went up again 3 points in the rankings of regional university in the South. We were 36 2 years ago, 33 last year, and 30 this year. We're now second in the Commonwealth, 5 slots behind Murray State, and we're closing that gap quickly. Some of the reasons for that, and you're all responsible, and I'd like to thank you for these. Our 4-year graduation rate has gone up over the period since 2006, from 20.6% to 27.2%. 5-year graduation rate from 40.8 to 44.3. We have the lowest average number of credits to degree, just under 140. We have increased the number of STEM plus health graduates by 28% from 900 to 1148, and we graduate more underrepresented, Pell eligible, and underprepared students than any other comprehensive university in Kentucky. And I'm sure all these were factors in calculating our rankings. Again, number 30 in the Southeast, we continue to rise. As our admissions criteria become more selective, we expect that ranking to be even higher, because one of the things that they look at is how selective your admissions criteria are. We're currently admitting, I believe, 92% of applicants. That number is going down, and that tends to improve rankings. Last but by no means least, I want to share with you just a few thoughts from the sabbatical reports that were submitted by faculty to my office as required. And I thought there were just an outstanding bunch of sabbatical reports, and without listing all the names and places, I want to share that approximately 15 faculty were awarded sabbaticals last year. They visited countries from China, Australia, Ukraine, Belize, Canada, Spain, and Vancouver, and a variety of states, both from coast to coast, New York, California, and just about everything in between. Again, I have these reports. I'm not going to read them verbatim, but I want to just excerpt half a dozen quick comments from them. One of the main reasons for sabbaticals, of course, is professional development. Faculty member A thanks us for, quote, one of the most rewarding experiences in my career thus far in the academy. Another faculty member cited a wonderful opportunity to focus on and advance their research. And someone else, you can probably figure out who this is, felt good to excel and dance again. Of course, we also value sabbaticals as what new knowledge and experiences those sabbaticals bring back to the university when you return. Another faculty member saying, quote unquote, I miss my babies, looked forward to her first rehearsals in August with a fresh perspective. Someone else said, I will continue to excite and ignite the interests of my students as a result of a sabbatical. And last but not least, a faculty member who, for security reasons, I will call Christine Arnold, said, I am excited to see my colleagues and students again and share with them my new work and stories. I have 3,000 new photos on my iPad. You have been warned.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Emsley. Our
yes. Said that you had approved all of the actions from the May Senate meeting and the handbook provisions, but the handbook provision that the handbook had to go to the Board of Regents for approval
right.
was not approved, was
correct.
That your veto or the president's?
It was not a veto. It was something I did not approve.
Okay. Could that be noted for the record? Then?
Sure.
Not all of the actions.
It did result in the 19th handbook, which was presented to the board as an information item, as in previous years.
Okay. Thank you. Our SGA president, then, Kiana Boca. Ms. Boca.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I hope your semesters have gone off to a smooth start. I would like to recognize our three University of Senate representatives. One is Samantha Brown. Samantha Johnson. She's our Glasgow student body president, and she'll be representing us at the Faculty Senate, and we're glad to have her. Nikki C., she's our administrative vice president, and Mark Reeves, he's our executive vice president. We've had a busy start to the semester already at SGA. This summer, Mark and I went to Washington, D.C. to meet with Kentucky senators and representatives to speak about issues in higher education. We spoke about the federal interest loan rate. We spoke about Pell Grants and university research funding. They were very receptive to our meetings, and they sat down and talked with us about what we would like and wanted to see in the future, and encouraged them to vote for certain things. And we also were there with other public universities across the state, UK, EKU, and also there? U of L. Yes, so it was a great experience, and I hope that's something we can do in the future. Another thing that we did, we expanded our Safe Ride program this year, scholarship programs, and many more to come. Our fall elections were this past week, Tuesday and Wednesday. It was very successful, and we now have student representatives from each of the academic colleges. And this upcoming Board of Regents committee meeting, we will be having a SGA committee report for the first time. So that's a great thing that we'll be represented on for the first time. But that's all. Brief report. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boca. Moving on to our committee reports. Graduate Council, we do have two reports from them. The May report. And where's my Graduate Council representative?
Here.
Hi. The first thing I need to do is to pull the final item on the August 15th, 2013, the adopting of the general guidelines for the temporary course offerings. Over the last week, we have discovered that UCC had changed the guidelines, and so we're going to withdraw it and bring it back forward.
This is on the August report?
On the August 15th report, it's the final item. With the exception of that, I move for approval of the Graduate Council agendas from May and August.
Okay. Is there a motion on the floor? I was looking for that final item.
Second.
Right. Any discussion? Sorry? Yes, graduate faculty only. That's correct. So graduate faculty only. Any discussion? Okay. Motion to approve the two reports with the change as noted. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Report is approved. Both reports approved. UCC. Any comment from the UCC?
No.
Okay.
No.
Academic quality?
No report.
Faculty welfare and professional responsibility?
No report.
All right. We like these things right now. General education?
Report.
All right, thank you. There's no old business on the schedule, unless anybody knows of any they would like to bring to my attention. New business is now in order. We have a number of policies that have come through the SEC. Let's start with policy 1.1120. That is the graduate assistant instructor credentials. Can I get a motion on the floor? Okay. Okay. Any discussion for the GAI policy 1.1120? Okay. Yes, I've been made aware of that. So that would need to go for revision for that. So, and I'm not sure who would do the revision on that particular policy, if that would be Graduate Council to do that revision.
It was currently before the Graduate Council. We have a revision on it.
Okay.
We sent it
Okay, I was told that that Graduate Council had approved it, and that's why it got on the Senate agenda.
We have not approved it. We just approved it.
Okay. So it got revised. We'll be back. So. So then we need to retract this item. Okay. Then I was made aware of that erroneously. Okay. We will pull this item from the agenda. Is there, I guess we need to make a motion to pull that item, or? Thank you. And a second? All right. Any discussion? In favor? Say aye. Any opposed? Okay. We will pull that from the agenda. We will revisit that. Let's move on to policy 1.5031, selection, appointment, evaluation, and reassignment of deans. Motion on the floor for approval? Any second? Okay. Any discussion? Okay. Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of approval of this policy 1.5031, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Approved. Moving on to policy 1.2150, short-term faculty-led study abroad compensation for summer and winter sessions. Motion to approve? Any second?
Second.
Any discussion? And hearing no discussion, then all those in favor of approval, policy 1.2150, please acknowledge by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, policy approved. I don't think we're going to be this fortunate for all of these, unfortunately. Policy 1.5041, that is selection, appointment, and reassignment of department heads / chairs. Motion to approve? Any motion? A second?
Second.
Any discussion? And hearing no discussion, all those in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Approved, 1.5041. Moving on to item number 5, which is policy 1.4033, engagement requirements for hour of credit. Motion on the floor to approve? A second? Any discussion? Wow, okay. I'll take it. All those in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Policy 1.4033 approved. Moving on to 6, policy 1.3140, priority registration schedule. Motion to approve on the floor? Any second?
Second.
And any discussion? Okay, hearing no discussion. All those in favor of approval, policy 1.3140, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And approved. Policy 1.1064, access to academic affairs, electronic personnel files. Motion on the floor to approve.
Sorry.
Any second?
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing no discussion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Approved. Moving on to number 8. Policy 1.3130, that is advising relative to declaration and change of program of study. Any motion to approve from the floor?
Sorry.
Any second?
Second.
All right. Any discussion on this item?
Yes.
Yes.
I was at the Park Hall
meeting. And if you could please identify yourself and then...
I was at the Potter College Faculty Advisors Workshop on Monday, and this proposal came to our attention. There was some question there, which is not in the policy memo here, about the rationale for the change to limiting it to once in this period. And so that was a question: to what extent is this really a necessary move? There's also some concern about potential deluge of paperwork within a limited amount of time, and how that would affect students who are changing majors outside of the specified time period.
Okay. I know Dr. Emsley has brought this, so if you'd like to address those questions.
I may ask Doug to help me with this one, but at this point in time, a student can change majors anytime they wish. Every day, if they so desire, are told. Well, that happens a lot, but we felt it was important that when a student requests a change of major, that what we call the receiving department, the department that the student is seeking a new major in, has ample opportunity to review the student's credentials, whatever, and make a decision and to accept that student into that department prior to the registration period for the following semester. So that registration period, for example, for spring opens in a few weeks. We thought it was important that the declaration of major was done early enough for the receiving department to admit that student prior to the deadline. If it happens after that, there's a possibility a student have to register for courses not knowing for sure what their actual major was going to be or who their advisor was. The other part of this policy, which is, I think, equally important, is that substantial research has shown that students who declare a major, even if it ends up not being the one they graduate from, have a much higher retention success than students who remain undeclared. And so we have a provision that a student must declare a major prior to 60 hours or their first full term at WKU if they're a transfer student. So first, it essentially forces the students to declare a major, and it coordinates the timing of that declaration such that the departments involved can provide appropriate advising to that student with the timing relative to the registration period for the upcoming term. Doug, you want to add anything to that? Or
I think the only thing I would add is that we also felt that this came out of discussions in the retention task force, and we also felt that it was important that students think intentionally about their changes in program of study and use it as an opportunity, a learning opportunity and a thoughtful opportunity, as it is right now. As Dr. Emsley said, students can change their program of study on a daily basis. And that generates actually an enormous amount of paperwork that would be cut down significantly by restricting it to this time window. It would also, we close this time window in a period of time when the professional advisors in the various colleges have indicated that they would have time to focus on getting those requests processed without the competing demands of students coming in for advising appointments and so on. And so really the intent is to actually streamline the process, both in terms of amount of paperwork, and actually paperwork would disappear, this would be entirely online, and also to time it such that it could be done efficiently and effectively.
Okay. Further discussion. I think there were some other questions and comments. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Over here, you were first. Yes.
Am I on? I'm Shura Polachek, Department of Theater and Dance. I wanted to offer a sort of friendly amendment suggestion that maybe an exception to this policy could be for changes of major within a given department. We offer a BA degree and a BFA degree, and students sort of apply and audition at the end of the semester of their third semester, and just logistically for us, this, I understand the reasons for it, but logistically for us, this would be counterproductive, and I imagine other departments might have similar issues. For us, so if a student is not accepted into a program, they often have a major change, and that's something we want to resolve between the end of that semester and the beginning of the next one. And even though it's within our department, it is a change of major, so it seems like an unnecessary logistics issue.
Okay, let's go ahead and another comment. There's one right here.
Oh, well, mine was actually about that department. I was at the advising meeting earlier this week, and one of the faculty members in that department had said as well, would this apply to faculty initiated changes in major. And so if a faculty member wanted to change a major for a student, would they also have to wait during to do it during that period, or would they need to, could they do that at any time as well? So.
Okay. Are you meaning like as opposed to student initiated changes, would advisors or faculty be able to initiate the changes outside of that window?
Right. I understood that question. Yes. So we'll go ahead and take a couple of more comments, and then we'll see if we can get some answers to some of these. In the back, I think we had a comment.
Yes.
We'll come to you next.
Steve Miller, Department of Educational Administration. I have not seen the data that you're talking about, but something that you said just really screams out as faulty. You have what appears to be correlational data, and you're claiming that those that have declared a major have higher retention rates. How do you know that those who have not already decided to stay are more likely to declare a major? I don't think you have any time lag data there to show that that's causal rather than correlational. And for a university, that seems to me rather an egregious claim unless you have time lag data.
I'm not sure who's.
Okay.
This was done by institutional research.
Let's go ahead and take. We'll take one more. Let's go ahead and take one more comment.
Correlational data.
Okay. Let's go ahead and.
Just
yes.
Two points. Pruitt sociology. I share the concern. I think that's probably a very good example of a spurious correlation. Not to say it's not desirable to go ahead and have them declare a major, but the likelihood that anyway, get away from the spurious bit of that correlation. I also just have a concern. Sort of pragmatic concern with regard to saying students then can declare a major from week 5 through 7 in the fall semester, and if they wait to week 8, then will not be able to change a major until week 5 of the spring semester, and then not get into those courses or know if they're going to be into this major. It seems like we want to retain students and get them to matriculate properly through programs that we would want to do anything when. We'd make it as easy as possible for someone to change a major and to know that they're accepted into major and then go ahead and start coursework in that area.
Okay. Let's want a follow-up. Yeah, just a follow-up. Did we?
Yeah, that was...
Was that a...
No, yeah, it's kind of a piggyback off of that, is that it might create some more confusion from the students, too, who have advisor holds, because all students now have advisor holds on their top net account, and so they have to be advised before they can register. But if they miss the window and then they have to be advised by, you know, then who advises them? Certainly we wouldn't want someone in sociology advising someone who is planning on changing a major to biology or nursing or something like that. So then now the advisor thing is unofficial.
Okay.
You know, so it just, I think it's just going to create some confusion.
Right, okay. Let's
see
if we've got any other different concerns. Who is, you're pointing at someone. Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't see you back there at all.
I'm a senator, so I appreciate the recognition. Many of our programs that have selective admissions would not admit students until after this window, and so then that's when they would change their major officially for the next semester.
Okay. All right. Any other questions real quickly, and then we'll see if we can get some response to this. So, yes.
Another point, I'm Dawn Wright from nursing, is that many of our students find at the end of a semester they've been unsuccessful in a selective admission program, and what are they going to do? And oftentimes they go somewhere within our college, which works, but I didn't know if this policy precluded them doing that.
Okay. I think we have a number of questions then on the floor and comments on the floor. If someone would like to address any of those or all of those. Either Dr. Inslee or...
I think they're great questions, and we can certainly look at addressing some of these. Right off the bat, I don't think it says that a student would not be allowed to change a major any other time. This is trying to streamline it into a kind of normal window. If someone really came up in week 10 with a change of major request, I think we'd allow that. The issue again would be that student would have registered with a sociology advisor even though he changed a major to biology, and that's what kind of happens now. So this is an attempt, again, as I said at the beginning, to ensure that any student contemplating a change of major has had a chance to discuss this and be accepted by the biology department prior to registering for a bunch of biology courses that may or may not count toward their eventual major, depending on their acceptance or not. In terms of changing major within a department, I don't see any major issue with that. Again, if the receiving and giving department are the same, that certainly should expedite the communication process. I'm a little puzzled with this faculty-initiated changes. I'm sure the student has to be involved at some level, right? Help me with that.
Well, the way that I would define that would be, as an advisor for the English department, I could initiate a change when a student comes in to talk to me for an advising meeting.
Sure.
So it wouldn't be the student off by him or herself just saying, oh, I want to do this.
And that's exactly what we're trying to do, is get this to be done in consultation with an advisor.
Right.
During a kind of concentrated session where this could occur.
When you say that you're not sure what would preclude anyone from doing this at other times, I guess I'm not really sure then why we're having the policy at all. If we're still going to be able to do it whenever, but we're trying to persuade them to do it between these weeks?
That's what I would... I mean, I think the students can late register, but that's not what we encourage them to do. We have a registration period, and this, I would imagine, would be the same. I don't think we're trying to put barriers up. We're trying to streamline the process so that this can proceed in an orderly fashion.
Okay.
And that student can have confidence that their new major will, in fact, be their new major before they enroll for courses for the following semester.
So would it be maybe then a policy that would, could it be revised in some way to say that it would encourage students to do this if they wish to be ensured that they're going to have that policy change or the major change go through before the next semester? I think that would clarify language for us, for the advisors, certainly, because that was not what we understood from reading the policy and discussing it the other day.
Okay, yes, comment.
My only comment on that is it appears to be that the problem is that you're trying to prevent people from changing their major every day. So if that's the goal, why not just have you can change your major once during any semester period? Why have a window? So a window doesn't address the issue of changing all the time. It puts a new log in the way of the student from completing their academic education. So I would recommend that what we need to do is just have such an automated system that we have that it can be changed once, and then once it's changed, boom, you can't change it a second time until the next semester. Clicks over.
I'd be fine with that, but I also think that, again, whether we encourage or whatever, that the optimum time to do that is at a time where after the fifth week assessment, if that's an issue, and in time for the receiving department to admit the student prior to the registration period of the following term. That was the idea of creating this optimal window, if you like. We can certainly look at whether this is a suggestion or an encouragement or...
I would say my first time at the university, that may be an administrative benefit, but not a student benefit.
Okay. Do we have any additional comments on this item?
If I could just offer a little bit more perspective, a lot of the concerns that I've heard dealt with selective admission programs, nursing, some of the other programs, I assume some of the arts programs as well that require the audition and so on. This policy, as written, would deal with student-initiated changes. That is, those changes that involve a student in consultation, hopefully with their advisor, going on to TopNet using the change of major form. It would certainly allow, and we would like it to be exception, we imagine it best as an exception, allow administrative changes. Now, that may be a somewhat fine-scale distinction from just an advisor-driven change, but an administrative change. If a student is not admitted into a selective program, or if there is some compelling reason why the student needs to change their major, that's the kind of thing that could be done at an administrative level. Typically, that now is done through the AARC. Okay, it's not something, as I understand it, if an advisor wants to assist a student in changing their major, the advisor works with the student to go online to TopNet and use that online advisor form. That is different from an administrative change, which is handled by AARC to deal with these, or perhaps professional advisors in the colleges, the ACE Advising Center and Health and Human Services and Gordon Ford and those others, to deal with those situations where students really do need to change really do need something, and the timing just simply doesn't align with this proposed window. the main reason for restricting it as well is to actually encourage students to go through the process. Right now we have a number, not a small number of students, who remain undeclared even into their senior year, even though they're pursuing a degree program. They just haven't ever bothered to officially change their major. The concern is they're not getting good advising. They're out there floating with the incorrect major. So this is actually also an attempt to encourage students to actually go through the process, make it official, and get the type of advising that they need in the programs that they really want to pursue.
Yes, comment. Yes.
I would like to move to refer this policy to the policy subcommittee of the UCC. My reason is that a number of concerns have been raised, and there have been answers and interpretations, but the fact is once we move and pass this policy, the letter of the policy is the law, and all these interpretations and explanations go to the wayside. So I think we need to just take a deep breath and take a little time and make sure that it says what people want it to, and then bring it back next month.
Okay, so we had an initial motion on the floor, and so now we have, okay, so now we have our next motion on the floor. Our motion that takes precedent is to refer this item back to UCC. To the policy subcommittee of UCC, absolutely. And so there was a second on that. Is there any discussion on that item, on that motion? Okay, on that motion then, let's go ahead and take a vote. So all those in favor of the motion to send this to the policy subcommittee of the UCC, please acknowledge by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so our motion then carries for that, to send that back to the subcommittee for UCC. So moving on to number nine. We have a number of things within the Colonnade Implementation Committee, number of exploration courses. I would ask if there would be a motion on the floor to bundle these, or if you would like to take them one at a time. We'd be happy to do that as well.
I move approval of all the courses.
Okay. Is there any discussion on that?
I would like to raise one issue. These courses actually combine two committee meetings in May and August. In May, we were still working on the assumption that we had to give distinct approval for C courses with University College. Since then, we've been informed that approving a course, a department course, automatically approves the University College version of that course. And so, in effect, these like 100 Cs and 110 Cs, those are now redundant, is my understanding. And that, in fact, approving these courses approves the University College version as well.
Okay. We don't need to retract those items or anything, though, from this. Okay. Any further discussion on that? All right. All those in favor of approval of the bundle of all of these courses from the Colonnade Implementation Committee, please say aye.
Aye.
And any opposed? All right. Moving on to number 10. There's a new course proposal here. I realize this is not within the UCC report. This did not come bundled in a UCC report to SEC, but the course proposal did come through SEC alone, so SEC has approved this. The new course proposal is for UC 100, and so I would like to put that up if there's a motion on the floor for approval.
Second.
Any second?
Second.
All right, any discussion? Okay. Hearing no discussion, then all those in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, approved. And moving on to item number 11, we do have two elections today. So we've got ballots. We actually have ballots with names on them, as we have a number of different people up for these. So we're going to take election number one, which is for... So, okay, yep. We're going to take... Excellent. We'll hand out. We'll have both of these. We're going to take the first one is going to be for representatives for the University Academic Complaint Committee. The ballots are clearly labeled at the top, so you'll be able to find those.
as you begin to get these ballots, you will see that there's a different selection process for each one of these elections. So for the University Academic Complaint Committee, we do have two different pools that are on that ballot. You'll see as you get that. That is the faculty pool and then the student pool. So when you get your ballot, it will look something like this. So in, at the top, we do have instructions for that to please choose four faculty candidates. So four of the six faculty candidates, please mark four. So you can circle those, mark your choice clearly for four faculty candidates. And then for two of the four student candidates that are listed. So four faculty candidates from the faculty pool, mark your choices of four of those. And please mark two out of the student pool. So just, yes, you can circle or check or just mark those clearly, please, for us.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, you have two total ballots. Yes, yes, you have two total ballots. One ballot is for the University Academic Complaint Committee. The second ballot is for the Student Research Council. So this up here in front right now is the University Academic Complaint Committee ballot. Again, we're choosing four from the faculty pool and two from the student pool. For this election. When you move on to your second ballot, the ballot for Student Research Council. And if that'll come up. You can fold them and go ahead and, oh, divide them up. Oh, yes, if you could do that, that would be fantastic. You could make two separate piles for these at your table. That would be excellent. And unfortunately, I'm not finding the, oh, here, no, here. So the Student Research Council ballot, just one person, please, for that. Just please make two separate piles at your table for each one of the ballots, and then we'll have our vice chair and secretary come around and various people to come around and pick those up.
I will email the result.
Okay, we will email the result. results. The vice chair has said she will email the results to you once we have counted those ballots. So we'll find out. We'll move on to number 13. Number 13 on our items of new business, Dr. Ransdell has contacted me, and he is interested in having a Q&A, question and answer session with the Senate. Some items that he proposed for discussion were health insurance, campus budget, the upcoming higher education budget model for the General Assembly, that the General Assembly is coming with. He's actually going to talk to Senate in October about that, so that may be already done. But anything else that the Senate wanted to talk about was what he proposed as a discussion possibility.
That surely sounds like a Halloween.
I know how I'm
so, so he has given me three possible dates that he is available at 3:45, and that would be October 10th, October 31st, or November 7th. So those are the three possible dates for this. And so I would just like to get, if you could just quickly check your calendars, just figure out what dates you might be available for one of those. So, well, that's true, but I kind of wanted to get it done.
Well, it's not work. We don't have to do that. That'll be a faster way to get it done.
Not for the person creating the doodle poll, which would probably end up being Jen or Heidi. So, not gonna do. You do elections. I don't do elections. So, yes. Okay, so 10th of October, Grad Council is going to be meeting that date. So we may get to say there's one date out of that, so that gives us two. That might be an easier selection to do then in this case. This is special session. All I'm doing is trying to choose the date that the most people are going to be available. So it's not really a, you know, hey, I agree that I'm going to show up at this particular time. It's a, I agree that, you know, I'm going to be available on this date or I'm going to be available on this date. Just kind of a show of hands just to get a general consensus of who might be available for those dates. So so I think if we narrow this down to two dates, if we narrow it down to, well, what would be Halloween? Not the best day necessarily. Or if we say November 7th.
Yeah.
See, I think this goes. So I don't think we need a doodle poll for this. So any discussion on that real quickly?
Is the president not available?
The president would like to speak to the regular Senate in October. He does have an item for his agenda for that, and so he wanted to have a regular question and answer session with the Senate, which I felt like would extend the meeting time for our regular business, so that this would be better served for a Q&A during a special session. So, yes.
Can we ask the president to host his item before the October Senate meeting? Because I think it's helpful if we have a chance to review.
Absolutely.
Rather than just hearing his presentation and having to respond.
Absolutely. I will request that to be the case if he has that information at hand, yes. Any other discussion about that? So can I just get a quick kind of show of hands just so I've got for November 7th, who's kind of on board for November 7th, 3:45. Okay, that looks good. Excellent. Thank you very much, and you saved me from doing a doodle poll, which is fantastic. So we will get you more information on that as to location. I don't have a location or anything for that yet, but we'll figure some information on that.
Did you vote for the 31st or
did
you miss
it?
It's Halloween.
It was Halloween, so everybody kind of went no. So.
Yeah, I don't think I take the kids trick or treating.
So we'll go with the majority on this. Being said, we'll go with the majority. Okay, so that's new business. Are there any other new business items that anybody would like to bring to the floor? Okay, we're going to move on to information items here. We've got several different things on here. We have policy 1.5041, which was an accompanying item for one that we already did. So I think that if you wanted that item, you already saw that item for the accompanying information. So moving on to number two, which was policy 4.2203. It's recruitment and selection. And this has been reviewed by the SEC. It's been commented upon by the SEC, and those comments then have have been considered and incorporated into the document. And SEC did have a lengthy discussion over this particular document. So Tony Glisson was present at the SEC meeting. I invited him here today, but I think he was at a conference and unable to make it today. So we did have a healthy discussion over this. So I invite any discussion from the floor, if there are any particular items of discussion from the floor, and then I'll take any written comments or review or anything that you have as well emailed to me for the Senate to make a written document on this. Yes, Dr. Miller.
Margaret, one of the things that I noticed, even though the Senate is not going to vote on this, I did note that under 2, let's see, this policy precluded the use of waivers. And that's a problem, as far as I'm concerned, because there are exceptional cases that may occur from time to time where a waiver is necessary. The policy limits non-competitive searches to 6 months or less. And I think in most cases that would be fine, but in the case of faculty, let's say, for example, that you have a last-minute resignation in July, and there's not enough time to conduct a search to fill a full faculty position. So you're going out and you're searching, you identify someone that you want to fill in for 6 months. I don't think you're going to be able to attract someone and say, well, we'll hire you for 6 months, but we can't guarantee the other 6 months. So you have to have a situation where you can hire someone on a non-competitive basis for at least a full academic year. And so I have proposed some additional wording to this to say that for non-competitive searches, if waivers are approved, then that person could be employed for up to 12 months. And that's the comment that I made.
Thank you very much, Dr. Miller. I was just looking for that section in here, non-competitive appointments.
It's 3G.
It's 2C.
3G.
3, strategic opportunity, critical need hires.
It's the first bullet under letter C, I believe.
Oh, under C?
Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
I was thinking it was under G. That's what, yeah, that's what I was thinking. It was under G.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so down, actually, page 9. Is it page 9 then? Strategic opportunity, critical need hires. Was that the section? Or?
3G, non-competitive.
Was it at the, that was grant or contract non-competitive appointments?
Yeah, there's a whole section 3G, like 5 cases.
Yeah, I was just looking for the 6-month number that was on there. I can't find the section on there. Does anybody have that section at hand?
What were you looking for, Margaret?
The item where it said 6 months, exactly.
Two,
well, that's
point C on page 2.
2 point C on page 2.
Yes, this is a policy. Says this employment not subject to this policy because of part time. We should know what we're talking about here.
So under C, okay, so employment not subject to this policy. The employment of individuals in full-time or part-time positions with a duration not to exceed 6 months, is that what you, okay, so that's the section. So right, so this is the section under C on page 2 is what Dr. Miller is referring to.
Basically what I'm saying is that on an exceptional basis, when approved by a search waiver, individuals may be hired on a non-competitive basis up to 12 months.
Okay. Any further comment or discussion about this?
Well,
I hate to argue my own vice provost, but I think 2C, Rich, is talking about types of employment. For the total duration of employment is designed to be less than 6 months, like seasonal employment or whatever. I think any discussion of waivers would belong in 3G, which lists a variety of appointments that are not subject or not do not require a search. I think the previous version of this policy didn't address waivers either. So essentially, by introducing a set of types of appointments that are not require a search, you kind of omission by exclusion. It looks like waivers are no longer allowed. The original policy didn't mention waivers either, I think. But I think to address this, possibly an extra paragraph in 3G would take care of it. Because it's an appointment which could, under normal circumstances, last for much longer than 6 months, but you're trying to fill on a waiver basis. It's not a 3G. It's not a job that by its nature lasts for less than 6 months.
Any comments, any Senate comments on this particular item? Okay, if you have any comments that you would like to, if you review this and you have any comments you'd like to send along, please email those to me within the next, week or so, and then I will get those to Tony Glisson and to Dr. Emsley for review on this particular policy. So let's go ahead and move on to our third information item. And these are really just some information for you all. Oops, as I pull down the agenda. Just information for you all to have in that the Ad Hoc Committee on Faculty Governance, they had presented a report to the SEC. The SEC is reviewing that, is in process of reviewing that, and I have reappointed, perhaps not to their pleasure, but I've reappointed the Ad Hoc Committee on Faculty Governance as we feel that there are going to be a number of revisions to this particular document, and so that is in the SEC right now and will come forth to the Senate within the next few months, so just kind of keep an eye out for that. But I did want to notify you that the Ad Hoc Committee on Faculty Governance is still there, still in existence, and helping us out with this. On the fourth item for information, I have spoken with Klaus Ernst, one of our Senate representatives. Actually, I've also spoken with Rich Gelderman, our other Senate representative for the Benefits Committee, and we should expect a Benefits Committee, a full report from the Benefits Committee in October at the October Senate meeting. I know that that has been requested. A number of people have approached me about that and requested that Benefits Committee package, so we will get a report from them in the October meeting, and I just wanted to let you know, yes, it is on the radar. They expect to have some numbers by then to be able to tell us about that. Are there any further items of business or comment that anyone has? Yes.
It doesn't have it. Oh, yeah. It doesn't have an on-off switch. Usually I'm on the agenda, but I am the COSTL rep. Molly Kirby, for those of you who don't know me, I'm the COSTL rep, which is the Coalition of Senate Faculty Leadership to the CPE, and we are going to have a meeting on October 4th in Frankfurt to discuss benefits on the state level and how it's affecting all the universities. But also, that's the only thing that's on our agenda, so that if anybody has anything they would like for us to discuss while we're there, just send an email to Margaret. Margaret can forward it to me. If you know me, you can send it to me. And that gives us I can send it ahead of time to our chair, and we can discuss that at that meeting on the 4th.
Okay. Molly, if you'd remind me, I'll get you on the agenda.
Yeah.
Okay. Any further items for discussion, comment, informational items? Everybody just pleased that we actually got through this agenda, as I am. Okay. Well, I tell you what, since we got through this all today, let's go ahead and see if we can get a motion to adjourn. Second. And all in favor, just stand up. Thank you very much.